Hey everyone, this is Pete Collins, one of the former Photoshop guys with Kelby One, currently looking for a new gig. You, however, are listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with Sharky James. Thanks, Sharky.
Welcome to the Petapixel Photography Podcast, episode 45. Brides Magazine upsets hungry photographers. In this episode, Brides Magazine publishes an article that wedding photographers didn't appreciate. David Beckham's teenage son gets a sweet gig. GoPro slims down its lineup. Yahoo makes cuts, but where does that leave Flickr? Hikers find an old camera lost many years ago. Panasonic announces three amazing new sensors. And the FAA announces a massive no drone zone. All that and more in episode 45 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. Thank you so much for opening the show, Pete. If you follow what Scott Kelby and crew over at Kelby One do, you know Pete Collins. He was one of Kelby's Photoshop guys, co-hosted Photoshop User TV, was a regular contributor on their other shows, was a columnist for Photoshop User magazine, is an accomplished photographer, artist, and illustrator, and now he's available. You see, sadly, a few days ago, Kelby One had to make some pretty tough cuts as they restructured their business. As a result, Pete Collins, RC, Mia McCormick, and others will no longer be working at Kelby One. But they're leaving on good terms from what I understand, and we wish them all the best. You know, someone out there is going to snag these folks, and they're going to be really happy that they did so because they're all huge assets to whoever gets them. And we wish the best to Scott Kelby and crew as they restructure their business and continue to pump out great, great content. If you'd like to see Pete Collins' work and wish to connect with him, head on over to PeteCollins.com. Find him online and tell him we said hi. Pete is a really great guy. And hey, maybe we can convince him to do some Photoshop tips here on the podcast. What do you think? And I'd like to thank you all for joining us here in episode 45 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. We appreciate you all so much. And thank you all for subscribing, rating, and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever else you listen to us. We also appreciate you telling your friends about us and helping to spread the word. Okay, with that, I'm your host, Sharky James. Let's hit it. If you're a wedding photographer or you want to be one, you may take issue with an article recently published in Brides Magazine, as well as on their website, in which wedding planner Sandy Malone encourages all to not feed photographers at their wedding. Yeah, can you believe that? The focus of the article was to tell brides which vendors it was okay to not feed, but photographers, of course, are taking issue with their inclusion on the do not feed list. It's customary here in the United States to feed the photographer, and there's a good reason for that. They're with the wedding couple from the moments that they're getting dressed and heading to the church or venue all the way up to the end of the evening when the last guests are leaving the reception. Sometimes this is as much as 10 hours of work in one day. They're putting in an incredibly long day on their feet, capturing irreplaceable moments, and if you're smart, you feed them and keep them going strong. After all, if the photographer is hungry and feeling weak, the photographs may suffer. And not only should wedding photographers be fed, in my opinion, they should be fed first. The sooner they're fed, the sooner they're ready to shoot the rest of the night's festivities. Now, in the article, Malone encourages brides to examine the contract that they have with their photographer to see if feeding them is explicitly required. And of course, if it's not in there, you can skip feeding them. She says that wedding planners, which she is, should be fed, but photographers need not be. Well, that's convenient now, isn't it? In the article, Malone says, quote, "As for other vendors, my general rule is that if you're working just the wedding itself, feed yourself or pack a lunch to eat in the staff break area if you cannot survive the shift. A photographer, for example, should be taking pictures through the wedding dinner with some breaks to let people unselfconsciously feed themselves without a camera in their faces." End quote. Now, I disagree with that. I'm not a wedding photographer, but I've shot a few before, and I can tell you that you can quickly eat and still have more than enough time to get the shots of others eating. Besides, couples aren't buying a whole lot of photographs of people feeding their faces, and you know what? People don't want to be photographed that way anyhow. So I disagree with her wholeheartedly. A wedding photographer doesn't need to be shooting throughout the entire meal. Now, she makes exceptions for photographers who are traveling from out of town, and especially for destination weddings that are, you know, really far away, Costa Rica or whatever. But excluding photographers just isn't cool, in my opinion. Twitter user Rachel Fesco wasn't at all happy about this article, saying, quote, "Literally the worst advice ever." Apparently, the @brides writer didn't actually speak to any hashtag wedding professionals, end quote. Now, this is just weeks after Vogue magazine went a step further, saying that you don't even need to hire a photographer at all for your wedding. Yeah, amazing. You know, this is just a sign of the times. Everyone is bombarded with images on a daily basis, as I've said here before on the show, and people just don't respect the profession of photographer anymore. So this really shouldn't surprise us. For some insight into this, I reached out to Paul Drew, Sony artisan and author of Digital Wedding Photography, for his thoughts on this.
That brides.com article created quite a storm, especially among photographers. And while I agree with the writer of the article that you should honor the contract for anybody who has a meal written into it, I think a bride and groom should really consider offering some type of food to their photographer, especially given the fact that most wedding contracts are 8 to 10 or even more hours per day. That's a long time to be carrying gear, to be looking through a lens, straining to create something that's really artful and really well done technically. So having that little break for 15 to 20 minutes, even if it's just a vendor meal, I think is a great thing to do for your photographers and even your other vendors like bands and DJs. I think it's just kind of a courtesy. We see it all the time here in California. It's something that most people expect to pay for. I don't expect a sit-down meal. I don't necessarily need to be seated with the guests. If there's an area where I can go quietly with my second photographer and just kind of chill for about 20 minutes, I find that's great. And it gives guests a break from us and being photographed. During that time, the bride and groom and their guests are typically eating, so it's not a time when I would normally be photographing. So I think the rule of thumb should be to feed your photographers, especially given that they're working for a long day carrying a lot of gear doing their job.
To learn more about Paul, head on over to his website at pauldgero.com. That's PaulGero.com. It's got a lot of great information out there for wedding and portrait photographers and photographers in general. On Petapixel, we took a poll, and as of this recording, with a whopping 23,000 plus respondents, an overwhelming 87% say that photographers should always be fed at weddings. A little under 10% said yes, sometimes. A little over 0.5% said yes, rarely. And a tad under 2% said no, never. So there you go. Photographers want to be fed and think others should be as well. How's that for solidarity, huh? Now, as a side note, as of this recording on Saturday, February 6, 2016, it appears that the article has been deleted from the Brides Magazine website, but an archived copy of it shall live forever in the Wayback Machine on archive.org. So I find it interesting that they've removed it from their website. Hey, maybe suggesting that photographers not be fed wasn't such a great idea after all. Nepotism is a great thing if you're on the receiving end, but if you're not, it tends to grate on people. And we saw that this past week as it was revealed that Brooklyn Beckham, the 16-year-old son of soccer legend David Beckham, was hired to shoot a campaign for the premium brand Burberry. The brand hired the young photographer to shoot photos for its next fragrance campaign, and the photo shoot was broadcast live on social media. And wow, did that ignite a firestorm in the photographic community. I think it's pretty safe to say that Burberry likely wouldn't have hired him if he wasn't David Beckham's son. But you know what? That's smart business. He has a massive following, and so do his parents, so it makes a lot of sense from a business standpoint. Is that annoying, though? Of course it is. That's a job that would have gone to a working pro, but you know what? That's life. All indications, however, are that Brooklyn Beckham has a passion for photography, and we can all relate to that. So why not? Opportunities present themselves in life, and this is his chance to show what he can do. Now, if the photos suck, of course, he's going to hear about it, and he'll have to deal with that. You know, maybe it'll cause him to work harder and to raise his game, and there's nothing wrong with that. However, fashion photographer Chris Floyd told The Guardian that Burberry's hiring of Beckham was a, quote, devaluation of photography, end quote. And while he gave the company props for using this as a way to promote their brand, he wasn't at all happy that a seasoned pro didn't get hired instead. Listen, it's 2016, and Brooklyn Beckham, with his 6 million or so Instagram followers, many of whom are the demographic that Burberry hopes to reach, made sense to hire here. Sure, that's going to tick off many working pros, but that's the reality of the business in the age of social media. If you have a large following, you might be the one that gets hired. So work on that, I say. That said, if I was a fashion photographer and had a shot at that campaign, I'd probably be miffed too. But he has a ginormous following, and that's what they're after. It is what it is. But he's serious about photography, and that's good enough for me. Imagine being 16 and having that opportunity, right? Times have been fairly tough over at Yahoo, and as a result, they've announced that they're cutting 15% of their workforce, about 1,700 jobs, in an effort to get back to profitability. And as a result, Flickr is reportedly one of the businesses that will see some cutbacks. In its latest earnings report, Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer announced that the company saw a massive $4.43 billion loss in the fourth quarter ending December 31st, 2015. Yeah. Ouch. That is a lot of money to lose. She's planning to focus on products such as Search, Mail, and Tumblr, but noticeably absent was any mention of Flickr. It sounds like what they're going to be doing is reducing Flickr's resources and try to run it in a more efficient way, as they do with any other parts of their business. And who knows, Yahoo may be looking to sell off Flickr and some of their other assets. I guess we'll see. As I've reported on in the past, GoPro's stock has tanked, and they've slashed their workforce as it seems like the market is pretty saturated now. At least that's my estimation. If you already have a GoPro, how often are you actually replacing it? They are so darn good as it is, you're not looking to buy a new one every year. It's just like televisions. How often do you replace it? Not very often at all. I rarely even use my GoPro. You know, same with most people I know, because there's a lot of video that you have to deal with afterward, so you break it out on special occasions. And thus, you're not using it very often, so you're not replacing it very often. So maybe that's why things have slowed down for them. Everyone who wants a GoPro already has one, it seems. Well, the company just released their quarterly results, and they're not good. At all. Revenues for the quarter dropped 31% to $436.6 million compared to the same period last year, and the company lost $34.4 million in that quarter. As a result, the company has announced that they're cutting down its camera lineup to just three models starting in April 2016. They'll be ditching the $300 US Hero Plus LCD, the $200 Hero Plus, and the $130 Hero. And I think that that was part of their problem right there. They had too many models to choose from. The models which will remain are the $500 Hero 4 Black, the $400 Hero 4 Silver, and the $200 Hero 4 Session. So from April 2016 on, if you want one of the traditional form factor GoPro cameras, you're in for at least $400 soon. I guess they think that it's best to keep the pricier models, and everyone else can just get the square Hero 4 Session model from now on. We'll see if that strategy works for them or not going forward. GoPro CEO Nick Woodman says that a new flagship model called the Hero 5 will be announced sometime in 2016, but it's not exactly known how much it's going to cost. My guess is it's going to be pretty pricey. He also reminded investors that the company will be unveiling its drone called Karma sometime this year. But is anyone excited about this drone? If it's not much different than, let's say, a DJI Phantom, and you're not a massive GoPro loyalist, why would you get one? In my mind, they're going to have to do something amazing to swing things back in the other direction. I find this all to be quite surprising. You know, at one time, it seemed like GoPro could do no wrong. They defined what the action camera market was, and they were making money hand over fist, but not anymore. It's like they got drunk with their amazing success and then woke up with this hangover wondering what the heck happened. Now, the company says it's also developing products and solutions for virtual reality experiences, and you may recall that they acquired VR software company Color, that was with a K, back in April 2015. They partnered with Google to create that $15,000 US 16-camera VR rig called the Odyssey. That was back in 2015, and apparently GoPro thinks VR is the future. Here on out, it's going to be interesting to see what comes out of GoPro. There is so much competition out there for them now, and I think they're quite worried. And the stock price is reflecting that. It is nowhere near what it used to be. Imagine you're on a hike and find something unexpected along the way. Well, that's what happened to Ethan Field and Rob Campbell while hiking off-trail in Oregon's Columbia Gorge recently. With GoPro rolling, one of the hikers looks down and notices something shiny, which was covered mostly by rocks, dirt, and vegetation. It was an East German Exacta VX2A camera dating way back to sometime in the late 50s to early 1960s. And by the looks of it, the camera had been there for a long, long time, perhaps decades. On his Instagram account, Campbell said, quote, "Obviously, we were in a spot not many people have been, down a steep slope next to the creek," end quote. They discovered that there was film still in the camera, and they're working on getting it processed to see if there's anything there after all these years. And if the film actually reveals anything, we'll let you guys know, of course. But I don't think that's nearly as interesting as to how it ended up there. Did a hiker decades ago drop it and then decided it was likely broken due to the fall and it wasn't worth looking for? Who did it belong to? Are they still alive? We may never even know. These are all mysteries. You know, who knows what else is out there? You may find a camera on your next hiking trip, and it could have belonged to someone famous or someone just like you and I. Panasonic has announced a trio of new CMOS sensors that offer extreme dynamic range, incredible light sensitivity, and a global shutter. Which is interesting because when you think about camera technology, especially when it comes to sensors, Panasonic isn't exactly the name that comes to mind first. The first is an industry-first organic CMOS sensor that can capture a dynamic range that's 100 times wider than current sensors thanks to an organic photoconductive film that allows it to see objects despite being strongly backlit. Even when strong backlighting is present, the sensor is said to capture accurate and rich color tones, and that is quite an achievement right there. And since the sensor doesn't require multiple exposures to capture high dynamic range, it's especially well-suited for fast-moving subjects. Now, the second sensor is able to see in near darkness. Using what they're referring to as avalanche photodiodes, the sensor obtains 10,000x multiplication of the electrical signals, and as a result, that makes it extremely sensitive to light and able to capture sharp color photos under starlight and other conditions with a luminance of just 0.01 lux. Now, that's crazy talk right there. 0.01 lux is not much light at all. The third sensor is really interesting as it features what they're referring to as a, quote, highly functional, end quote, organic CMOS sensor that features a global shutter. It captures every pixel of the frame at the exact same time, and thus the sensor avoids the rolling shutter effect, which you see with many shutters. Now, I'm sure you've all seen video of an airplane propeller where it looks incredibly distorted, so you're familiar with what the rolling shutter effect is. A global shutter doesn't have that problem. Now, Nikkei reports that, quote, "Sony enjoys a market-leading 40% of global share and is chasing demand for automotive applications. Panasonic had scaled back its presence amid declining profitability in the semiconductor business, but the prospect of growth in high-end sensors has prompted it to resume development," end quote. This stuff may not seem all that exciting right now, but it's indicative of what the future holds for the sensors in our cameras. In a matter of years, you won't even care what ISO your camera is set to because it'll be irrelevant. You'll be able to capture an image with little to no noise in them, and that's going to be truly liberating. Now, those who make excuses will have one less excuse to give. And maybe then people will finally concentrate on doing quality work and making some great images. One can hope at least, right? Is the next iPhone going to have two cameras on the back of it? Well, according to Apple Insider, the larger iPhone 7 Plus, which is due out sometime later in 2016, will feature dual rear-facing cameras, incorporating technology gained by Apple's acquisition of Israeli startup Lynx back in April 2015. As you may recall, that company was developing multi-camera modules that promised to give smartphones DSLR-like performance. And we don't know exactly if that's true or not, but Apple obviously wanted that company's technology for a reason. One of the world's top Apple analysts, Ming-Chi Kuo of KGI Securities, says that Apple's larger iPhone model, the 7 Plus, will actually come in two different versions. One with a single camera module and a second with a dual camera design. It's said that it'll have dual 12-megapixel sensors, but remember, those aren't as good as the ones in your camera. These are tiny sensors. The smaller the sensor, the worse the light-gathering power, the worse the noise, etc. But one of these cameras will be dedicated to a wide-angle view, while the other will have a 2 to 3x telephoto lens. So that could be quite interesting. Mac Rumors adds that we may also see improved low light performance, reduced noise, and 3D depth mapping due to this. Now, most of us are shooting with dedicated cameras, of course, but as smartphones continue to get better, we're increasingly integrating those into what we do, right? Especially with social media. Whether you're a professional photographer or an enthusiast, most of us have Instagram, Facebook, etc., and it's just so much easier for us to share our photos from our phones to those places. Although as time goes by, many of the newer cameras, you know, through apps, can send photos to your smartphone and make those photos available for posting wherever, almost instantly. For instance, my Sony RX100 Mark IV is able to do that via a Wi-Fi connection from the camera to the phone. I mean, it takes like no time to make that happen. These iPhones and Androids are capturing better and better quality images, and people are turning to their phones more than their cameras a lot of times. I mean, sure, you can take your camera out and take a picture and jump through all those hoops to get it into your phone and onto Instagram. But if the camera in your iPhone, let's say, is really good, or it's good enough to get the job done, that's what you're going to do. As image makers, these are all tools. And sometimes the best tool is the phone that's in your pocket. So I find a dual rear-facing camera to be very interesting. There's a lot you can do with that. And imagine what we're going to have in just 5 years' time. Craziness. Just wait till we have incredible optical zoom lenses in our phones. That is going to be really cool. Smartphones are never going to replace a traditional camera, of course, for most photography. But if you're going to take pics with your phone, it might as well be the best quality that you can get. Now, this should go without saying, but if you own a drone, flying it near the Super Bowl or any major event like that is not a good idea. In fact, with the Super Bowl specifically, the FAA has declared it a no-drone zone. Actually, drones and other model aircraft are not permitted to fly within a 32-mile radius around Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara, California, between 2 p.m. and 11:59 p.m. on Sunday, February 7th, 2016. That's the day the Super Bowl is happening, of course, and this episode is being released. You know, I love how everyone has to make it 11:59 p.m. rather than 12 a.m., lest people not understand what time midnight actually is, right? Because they should be saying midnight, but then it confuses people. Now, I don't know how many people are actually going to see it in time, but the FAA has even put out a public service announcement video to drive the point home on this. Those who violate the ban could be arrested and slapped with a $1,000 fine if shooting alone, or $27,500 if it's a commercial venture. But what I don't get is why they felt the need to make such a large radius. What can you do with a drone 31, 32 miles away, let's say, that's any threat to the Super Bowl or any event? Heck, even a mile away, you're a mile away. So why 32 miles? It's one thing to ban drone flights within 5 miles of an airport, but 32 miles from a football stadium? That's just kind of odd to me. We conducted a poll on Petapixel, and 79% said that the Super Bowl's no drone zone was way too big. 14% called it a bit too big, 4% thought it was the right size, and the rest, obviously jokesters, said it was too small. Too small. That's pretty funny. 32 miles apparently is not enough. 50? I guess that's a lot safer. Either way, if you own a drone, know the rules, use some common sense, and steer clear of these type of events. Just enjoy the game. Don't get yourself arrested. I'd like to thank you all for listening to episode 45 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. Don't forget to check us out at petapixel.com/podcast for the show notes and to see what else we have for you. If you head on over there, you can leave us a voicemail question that we can answer here on the show. Or if you don't feel comfortable leaving a voicemail, go ahead and email me at lensshark@gmail.com. And if you'd like to connect with me personally, hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, where I'm Lensshark. That's L-E-N-S-S-H-A-R-K. All right, with that, I'll see you all in episode 46. Well, it's f8 2/50 of a second outside. Time to shoot.
Please subscribe to the Petapixel Photography Podcast. My daddy is the host.